Okay.
Okay. Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You could check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up on our previous episodes. We most recently talked about High Flying Bird, and before that was The Man Who Would Be King. I've written a handful of things recently, including finally my masterpiece about Don Cherry and why I'm obsessed with John Cherry and why I can't figure it out. It's in no way a masterpiece, but it's a thing that exists. Yeah, and we also are doing or did a podcast about the Raptors championship, just a short podcast, just to talk about it, because it'll never happen again. So themacguffinman.com. All right, James.
All right.
Oh, here we are.
Here we are. We're half sick.
Yeah, when you add us together, we are half sick.
I'm three quarters sick. No.
No, you're like slang sick. I'm officially like doctor sick.
Yeah, but you know what?
Like Kawhi, I'm playing through the pain, though.
But the show must go on. Uh-huh. And we're going to talk about the movie Eighth Grade.
Yes.
And we're not going to say Gucci at the end.
We're not. We're going to say it all throughout, every time we finish a point.
But this was one that, I guess this was kind of on your list of movies to do. What made you want to talk about this one?
I mean, it's an amazing film. That would be, that's high up there. At the end of the year, like, understanding the folly of making a best of list and thinking of the best of movies of the year, yada yada yada, I still always think about like what was the best thing I saw in 2018, and because I know people ask me about it, and my answer was always it's either Tully or Eighth Grade, depending on the day. It's one of those two, and that's high praise if you've listened to our Tully podcast. I do think Tully has the slight edge, having like really studied both of them now. I feel like Tully's a slightly better movie, but I love them both dearly. So yeah.
Are you surprised Bo Burnham would be able to do this first time around? And I don't mean that as a Bo Burnham dig. I mean that as a first time director dig.
Yes, 100% yes. This is like this is for a first time filmmaker. This is a shockingly like good film. And Bo Burnham's career, like my knowledge of Bo Burnham as a comedian, like I just didn't like his special What. I've since rewatched it and think it's I still don't love it, but that's his 2013 special, but just because he's a little too fast paced for me, I can't handle it. Last night I watched his special from 2016, which I had never seen before, and I think if I had seen that special, I would have been less surprised by how good Eighth Grade was, because that special, I believe it's called Make Happy. That special's incredible. Like, it is so good.
Yeah.
And I have nothing but praise for it. And similarly, Eighth Grade, you know, and they're both very creative in, I don't know, like, Eighth Grade is just, like, it's a type of movie that you've seen before a million times, but it's not the style of movie you haven't seen before. You know what I mean?
I think so, but I want you to explain that a bit more anyway.
Well, okay, so it's like a teen movie, but just slightly not like every other teen movie. There's not really a real three-act structure to this movie. It's just kind of like, it is kind of vignettes, held together by an incredible performance by Elsie Fisher as Kayla. The tone of it is kind of like teen movie by way of horror film. The sound design is like weird and spacious and creepy, and the music is huge.
Yeah, also horror movie-ish.
Yeah, exactly. Design.
Yeah.
And also, I forget if I mentioned this already, but the fact that Kayla is like 13. Usually, we're seeing somebody that's been in high school for a year or two, who is the lead of your teen movie, and that's just not the case with Kayla. And also the fact that all of these kids in the movie look like kids as opposed to kids in the movie. So I think it's things like that, and there are moments in this movie that remind me of the Coen brothers. There are moments in this movie that remind me of David Lynch, and that's not common with teen movies, you know.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I want to want to have you explain it a bit more, because would you say it's just like, every other teen movie? I get the teen movie you and I have talked about the most, even though we've talked about a lot of teen movies a
Yeah.
lot. It's got to be Mean Girls. And when I think about this and Mean Girls, and you recommending this movie, and me knowing that you I care very deeply for Mean Girls as well, they're not the same movie at all to me.
No.
And that's why when you say that it's another teen movie, it's a movie about someone who is a teenager. I mean, who's barely a teenager, I think, importantly.
Yeah.
There isn't I that those two things are far away from me, even though we're talking about people who are within, I guess, 5 years of each other, but they seem like such different ages, and they seem like such different movies.
Yes, I agree. And I think the best way to describe it is like most teen movies are sort of when there's an adversary or an adversarial vibe, it's usually like Mean Girls is a perfect example of this. It's your protagonist versus like a clique, right? Like a group of people who are the cool kids. Whereas the battle in eighth grade that Kayla is going through is almost exclusively with herself. And as opposed to most teen movies being like battles against external forces, Kayla's battling with internal forces, and things that she controls, be it things that she's doing on her phone, her vlogs that she's doing on her computer, or just in general. I mean, the first two thirds of this movie, we do not see Kayla talking to a lot of people, like we hear her talking a lot, almost exclusively towards a computer. And other than her dad, there just aren't a lot of conversations that she has until she goes to high school and meets her shadow.
No, I think that that's a really big point. I wanted to get to that at some point, and I didn't know it would be this early, but I think that it lines up with the filmmaking style too. Like, well, I'll just stick with Mean Girls because I think you're right. It is kind of a perfect example of a lot of things I did want to touch on anyway. Mean Girls has those scenes where high school is like the jungle, or the mall is like the jungle, and it's very highly stylized, and it has more of that three act structure. It's pardon the pun, but it's a pretty shiny movie, you know what I mean? It is very plasticky in a lot of ways. It's very bright and colorful, and
And Tina Fey in general is like a very classical style of writer, Like the jokes are weird and modern, but the structure of pretty much everything she does is very classical.
I'd agree with that too. And so that seems like more of a traditional high school movie in that way. And then to speak what you're saying about this idea of a protagonist versus external forces, I think that Mean Girls is about a person trying to fit into a group dynamic, and eighth grade is so much more about a person kind of dealing with herself and her opinions of herself, and who she used to be and who she wants to be. And I think those are two very big things that I think we'll touch on more. And there's definitely a lot of overlap between a movie about yourself and a movie about fitting into a group. And there's a ton of overlap. Both of those notions will get touched on in either movie, but they're not the same thing. And this one, eighth grade, is so much more about Kayla thinking about Kayla versus Kayla figuring out a way to get Aiden or Kennedy to like her. And again, those are absolutely parts of this movie, but that seems to kind of take a back seat to this more internal part that is very central to this movie.
Yeah, it's like it's almost like she, especially in the early parts of the movie, like we see these traditional groups that she might want to be a part of, and just because she feels I don't know, this isn't something that she's running through in her brain, but she probably feels conditioned by society to want to be hanging out with Kennedy or whatever, or hanging out with Aiden. The movie is her realizing that, like breaking away from everything on her phone, telling her that that's what she wants, and realizing that that's not actually what she wants. She would rather tell off Kennedy and then go eat chicken nuggets with Gabe, And the technology is a conduit for all of those things. It's a conduit for so much teaching that happens before we even meet Kayla, before this movie starts. She spends her whole life learning that people like Kennedy and Aiden are to her are being like she's repeatedly being told, we're all repeatedly being told that those people are desirable people to want to be around. and you either learn that they're not, or you become an asshole yourself, you know? And I think it's important to realize that she spends, there's a lot of her learning about the world that is done on her phone that I think is communicated pretty quickly and pretty well in the movie, but that there's so much of that happening before we meet Kayla that just sort of instructs her to care about these things, you know? And that's true of pretty much anybody who isn't like confident in who they are as a 13-year-old, which I believe encapsulates every 13-year-old except like, like 1%.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of these movies, you know, you can just kind of say, hey, it's not so important to fit in with the popular group as it is to be yourself. And I think that, again, it definitely applies here, but this spends more time dwelling on the be yourself part of it. Yeah, and, you know, for sure. Even that sounds cliche and universal and all those things, but there's just more time spent on that interiority, and that makes this more of a, you know, a character piece than it does a high school piece to me. And I, you know, again, we're never going to separate a character piece about a girl, or I mean, I guess it's not high school, middle school, but you know, a teenage school movie. You're never going to separate those things. But I think that that is one of the things that takes this out of that, is that focus on the interiority and, just not so much of contrasting what makes you different from these other people and why that might not be the best thing to pursue them at the expense of everything, but who you are, and if you can still remain yourself by growing up and changing and maturing. And I think that the time capsules really speak a lot to that, that being a central part of what this movie wants you to think about.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think I feel like any teen movie that I have like really identified with or seen myself in is something that, like, I mean, this is the best example because this movie, seeing it in a theater, in a full theater, is like an emotional nightmare. It's something to behold. Like, I saw it in the biggest theater in Toronto, and on a Saturday night at 7 p.m. and it was an experience. I was literally like pulling on the skin of my face during the pool party sequence. Just because, like, I think as soon as that pool party sequence started, I was like, oh no, this is perfectly reflecting something that is happening in my life currently that is bothering me. And it's just like, I was just melting down. It was also really interesting to have three 13-year-olds sitting behind us next to a mom who was not prepared for the oral sex sequence. And that was very funny to hear happen behind me. Just like, you could hear the audible awkwardness. It was incredible. But just, I do think, like, the teen movies I do find that I really, really love, beyond the fact that, like, there are a lot of comedies out there that are about teenagers that I very much enjoy. The ones that I really identify with tend to be, I identify with them at times when I am not in any way going through what that person is going through. And it sort of ends up, like, the ones that you do identify with have to be sort of character pieces, as you're describing, because no matter where you are in your life, you can sort of identify with that on some capacity, you know, like the emotions that Kayla's feeling, like, to quote Bo Burnham, I've never been a 13-year-old girl, so I don't know exactly what she was going through, but I understand like some equivalent of these feelings, you know? And I think it just did a really good job of reflecting feeling anxious about the world through the lens of a 13-year-old girl.
Yeah, it's the kind of social horror movie aspect that, I mean, this isn't just that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's, I'm sure you remember Charlie Kaufman saying that, like, that was a movie he wanted to do for a while. It was just a horror movie, but nothing, you know, nothing violent happens. It's just played like a horror movie, but it's just, you know, someone trying to be a person. There is that, but it's not just that in eighth grade.
No. Yeah. And it's just an incredibly well-made film, I think.
Yeah. So
from every department.
I want to ask you about this, coming from a first-time director. It's not that, you know, really shiny, super cinematic kind of classical movie the way Mean Girls is. Not that that's super cinematic, but just, you know, to tell a high school movie, it's pretty cinematic.
Yeah, and there's like plenty of very Hollywood sort of, I don't know, it looks like that movie's made on a set as opposed to the real world, you know?
Yeah, no, 100%. And yeah. So do you think that, do you think the bar is higher or lower when you do a movie like this, that you don't have to jump through all those big hoops, but I think hitting all those tropes kind of makes it feel more familiar and makes people feel like, oh, this is a real movie that, you know, even if you're not thinking about directors or first time or whatever, but, you know, just that, yeah, that looks like movies I've seen. So I guess it's a well-made movie in a sense.
I don't know. I don't think like it's necessarily harder or easier. I just think it's different, you know? And yeah, I guess I just don't have much to say. Like, I don't think, I feel like, I mean, if I'm pointing to one of these two movies, Mean Girls or Eighth Grade, as like a more auteurist sort of movie, I'm pointing towards Eighth Grade, because it just feels like more, I am a director, all caps, you know, I am a writer. Whereas Mean Girls is a studio comedy. It's just a really, really good once in a generation style of studio comedy. You know, it's one of those Hollywood movies where everything went right. And I think both of these things are equally rare. They're just equally rare in totally different ways, you know?
Yeah, they're different rare creatures.
Yeah.
But they're both rare. Okay, so what about, and this is something that isn't just about teen movies or high school movies, but you can hear modern directors and writers and producers talk about, in film and television, the difficulty of depicting the modern world in a compelling way. And I mean that in the sense that a lot of life now is looking at a phone or looking at a computer.
Yeah.
And that just isn't that compelling by the nature of it. And there's no way to kind of accurately reflect life anymore without having that in it. And I think TV kind of lagged for a while on having people text a lot just because it was hard to make that interesting. Yeah. But especially anything directed at youth, it's just not going to connect if we're, let's just pretend everyone still called each other and met up in person to share to share details about their dates or whatever. So do you think that this does anything different? Do you think that this finds a compelling way to do that, or do you think it's so accurate that it doesn't have to do those things in a compelling way, as long as it's, you know, just a direct enough reflection of reality? Or I guess now you should put out the blanket statement of, we are going to talk about this in the way that 13-year-olds wouldn't talk about these things.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, we're 2 decades removed. So I think a key part of making it, like, never really bogging down this movie is that the phone isn't really the focus for very long. It's the focus a lot of separate times. But with the exception of the Orenko Flow montage, the Enya montage, there's not like a prolonged period of Elsie Fisher staring at her phone. Usually it's like there's always characters staring at their phones, be it Aiden or Kennedy's friends. Kayla uses her phone constantly to connect with various people just for small portions. Like that's how she meets up with Olivia at the mall, and Gabe, of course, towards the end. But they're all really short scenes, with the exception of the montage, the Enya montage. And I think that's the key, is that it's always there, but never the focus for long enough for it to get boring. And when it is somebody staring at their phone for a prolonged period of time, like pretty much every time we see Kennedy, almost every time we see Aiden, the whole point is that we're focusing on somebody else in the frame anyway, like be it Kennedy, Kayla like giving Kennedy shit for not thanking her for the card game, Kennedy not looking up makes it funnier, or Aiden staring at his phone until when Kayla has crawled over to him to talk to him during the school shoot or part of the school shooting drill. That becomes part of the joke. Or Kennedy not looking up as her mom is inviting Kayla to the pool party.
Kayla at dinner with her dad too.
Yeah. Well, and that's so that's sort of like a misdirect montage too, right? Because that sequence begins, you're right, but that sequence begins with sort of like a beginning that makes us feel like we're launching into what ends up being the Enya montage that comes a bit later. And then the joke of her being at the dinner table, because we get a close-ups of her phone, close-ups of her face. We hear the music as she's scrolling through things. And then, like, her dad breaks into this. And that joke is so good and is so funny. And the conversation that they have right after it is very funny and goes on for a long time in a wide shot. And both actors give an incredible performance. That's the... when her dad says, "Your food's getting cold," and she says, "I like it cold." Like, so goddamn funny and so perfectly 13-year-old. But that, just to go back to the phone montage thing, like, that's very quick.
Yeah.
And again, a misdirect. And the only time we really sit with it is the Enya montage, which again gets broken up by her dad. But still, we really get into the heart of it with the Enya montage. And that's kind of the only time it's like we have a whole scene of this.
Yeah, and about that dinner scene, though, and I think you're right to point out that that's different than the other times where we see other people. What's the purpose of that? I mean, it's funny, as you said. Are we supposed to like Kayla a little less as a result of this? Is just to see the dynamic that they have? It just seems so much of this movie is pro-Kayla, and, you know, she's... I just think she's endearing in so many ways, and she's, you know, her videos about, you know, being yourself, and that she's trying to help other people, and you know, in her interactions with Olivia, you know, and Gabe, and you know, the worst thing you can ever say about her for the most part is that she's just uncomfortable in these situations, but she's rarely being rude. But yeah. I think that comes off in the dinner scene. I didn't know why that's the one, especially early on.
Yeah,
still formulating an opinion.
That's a rudeness rooted in reality, though, right? Like, when you're 13 and having dinner with your parents, that they are people you see every day. This is something you do, theoretically every day, or at least pretty consistently. And I think the rule about it being Friday and her being able to do whatever she wants during dinner on Friday, I think, like, lets us know that they definitely eat together pretty frequently. And you're at an age where, like, your parents are the least cool people in the world, or in her case, just her dad is the least cool person in the world. So, yeah, you're being rude, but it's, like, it's just some sort of weird rudeness that is in all of us. And you never, like, there is no age where you appreciate your parents less than when somewhere between 13 and 17. You know, at some point in that period is when you are the least appreciative of what your parents do for you, and I think that's what we're seeing be reflected. You know, I don't think she's being rude. I think she's really just being 13.
You know? Okay, yeah, all of that. Which, yeah.
Because I did this. I used to do 100% used to do the same thing. I was just reading a book. You know, like. That's every dinner with my family. I was just waiting for when I could go back to reading, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's so, okay. So that's put the technology thing, and I think in an interesting perspective that I want to talk about, because that's so much of her reality. It's just that she is on her phone constantly just because of the, you know, the generation that she's born in.
Yeah.
Do you think this movie takes a positive or negative stance on the ubiquity of technology in the lives of people that age?
I think if it leans one way, it leans negative, but I also think it takes a realistic sort of stance to me. It feels like the stance at the end is, this is just a part of our lives and we have to learn how to work with it. You know, like we have to figure out how it works for us without it taking over our life. And I think that's what the movie is saying. And at some point, Kayla starts caring about the stuff on her phone too much. You know, the first 45 minutes of this movie is very phone heavy, and the second half is not anywhere near as technology heavy. And I think that's sort of a point where she realizes that she kind of needs to get out into the real world a little bit more, or is trying to, whether or not she realizes it. That's something that she should do. But at the end of the movie, she's still looking at her phone in the last shot, you know, and I think the idea is that we can't go back. You know, like this is the way it is, and now you just need to figure out how to manage it for yourself, you know?
Yeah,
I think it has a conflicted stance, and I think it leans more negative than positive, but I do think it's just sort of like, well, we have to figure out how to deal with this.
yeah, absolutely. I think that's right too, because I mean, I think it's telling that we meet the digital self of Kayla before her real self, right? Like
Yes.
we see her talking, we see her pixelated. And I just take that as being, you know, this is so central to who she is. It's not 100% of who she is, but we talked about her vlog a bit, which just seems to be wall-to-wall positivity. And I mean, I guess you could say she's doing that instead of living her real life would be the most pessimistic way to look at it. But it does seem so positive. It does seem like her phone lets her communicate with Olivia, which again seems like such a positive force.
Yeah, exactly. It's when she's staring at it with no clear destination where it's a problem, and when she's staring at it as a conduit to go somewhere else, be it to see Gabe or to see Olivia, that's when it's a positive, right? That's the stance that I think the movie is taking there. Yeah.
Oh, so if it's just kind of a default instead of just a tool to do
Yeah,
something else you would have kind of conceived
exactly.
of.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, Gabe. I mean, a lot of that brings us closer to the end. Or do you want to talk about that birthday party sequence a little bit more? Because I think the pool party is one of the more memorable sequences. I mean, probably even good or bad.
Yes, but I don't know, like I feel like a lot of what I can say about it is very self-evident. Because everybody feels super anxious because they just do a really good job of depicting somebody being thrown into a place that they're unsure of whether or not they belong here.
Well, how do they achieve that then?
Music is a big part of it. I think going from her second vlog and like the cut while we're staring at Kayla, and then we get a cut to her in the car with the dad or her dad l just looking at the house, and we're not hearing any of the sound from the like scene itself. We're still hearing Kayla talk over it, a little Soderbergh-ing touch. And then once the car door opens is when the music starts, and we still aren't hearing any sound from the scene until later on. I forget when it actually switches over, but you know, we see her talk to the mom, and the mom's like, "Where's your dad?" But we can only see her saying it. We can't hear her saying it.
What's that about?
It's pretty funny to me because it seems like she has a partner, but she wishes her partner was Kayla's dad. I think that's what it is,
Okay.
because that argument about the cake is so funny. That happens when Kayla's opening present, or sorry, not Kayla, Kennedy. Oh my God, it's so funny. Like, all the funniest things in this movie seem to happen by characters speaking, like when characters are speaking off screen. Like, those are the biggest laughs that I get. And this is just, oh, it's so, I love the sound in this movie so much, but that's a big reason why. And then just it's this really like horrifying sort of electronic music as we're getting all these quick shots of kids. At the after Kayla's getting changed and she's standing at the glass door waiting to come out, that like long zoom out as the camera tracks over and we see the pool, and then we get all these quick cuts to kids, like one kid's chugging Gatorade, and kids are diving into the pool, kid does the upside down eyelids thing, and one girl, the last,
Classic pool party
oh,
moves,
classic.
wall
And the girl walking upside down, like those last two especially, those last two shots are meant to show us like these kids. They're trying to present these kids to us as monsters, and it's kind of like it's very anxious, and it sort of puts you in Kayla's. I mean, she's not wearing shoes at this point, but you know, like metaphorical shoes. And then that the door doesn't quite open, like as she starts to open the door is when the music cuts, but that the door doesn't quite open, and it's this hilarious joke that it's a release to the audience. But then you're immediately back into feeling terrified for Kayla as she's walking towards the pool party, and. I think that is the incredible feat of eighth grade, is making you feel horrified, then laughing, and then immediately horrified again. You know, and I think that's I didn't make this comparison myself. I saw somebody comparing it, the tone of eighth grade to, I mean, it would have only been Get Out at the time, but it applies to us as well. But Jordan Peele's work as a director. And I think that's pretty good. It's pretty apt. Hmm. And, you know, it's not like a perfect comparison in any way, but it you can definitely see elements of comparison there. And I think that those horrifying things followed by a joke followed by immediately more horror is a pretty good way of comparing them.
Yeah, and I just think that for a 13-year-old, like, the mix of emotions and mood swings that come with being hormonal and teenaged, yeah. The notion of the tone bouncing back that quickly, I think, lines up very well with that as well.
Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, we've got a half an hour, and I haven't asked you, did you like this film?
Oh, yeah, I really did.
Yeah, that's good news. This is on the, like, we would be fighting if you didn't like this movie list.
Yeah, I liked it. I really, I enjoyed, you know, as we talked about the technology aspect. I mean, I was someone who, you know, likes a lot of, like, the beginning of Black Mirror. You know, there's a lot of anti-technology stuff that I liked, but it really would have felt like a waste of everybody's time if this was just about how bad, like, that yeah. straight up phones are bad, right? Yep. That just wouldn't have been worth it. And I agree with you. I think that if it takes a side, it takes a side on negativity. But it's not the Unabomber Manifesto. Like, we're not going backwards in any way. So let's just get that out of the way and move on.
Yeah.
And yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, it sounds like you liked it more than I did, but that makes a lot of sense to me still. Yeah, exactly. No, but it had a lot of big things, and it had a lot of kind of little touches that I enjoyed as well. And some of those, I think, caught me a bit off guard. And I was happy to see.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing I do want to point out, I mentioned it a little bit, is that this is a very small movie that is made in such a, like, beautifully huge way. And I mentioned seeing it in a theater and how fun of an experience that was. And the sound design on this movie is really fantastic. Like, all those ADR jokes that I was talking about, or maybe they're recorded on the day, I don't know, of kids saying, "Are you my mom?" as someone's, like, walking up to the stage. That kid that says LeBron James two separate times.
Yeah, see, that's so funny. It's, like, school to me.
Exactly. And the whole thing is, right, so that is something that would happen in another teen movie. But in another teen movie, you get a cut to the kids saying it. We never see these kids. They're just voices shouting things at an assembly, which is exactly how it feels when you're at an actual assembly. And this is the first time I've seen that properly captured. And it's not something I've ever thought about, but it's the second I saw it, I was like, oh, this is perfect. This is how it should always have been done. And yet it took to 2018 to figure it out. But the music in this film is so fantastic. And
yeah, I want to talk more about that.
Yeah. And it was clearly, like, the music was made, you know, I didn't need to read about this to know that the music was not meant to fade into the background like scores on so many movies. It was meant to be, like, almost music video-esque at certain points, and research has proven that to be true. And it's just so... We go from so loud to so quiet and back so many times. And as the movie ended the first time I saw it, I was just like... The sound in that movie was so impressive. And then I saw in the credits that Skip Livesay did the sound mixing. He did the sound mixing for Roma. He does the Coen Brothers stuff. Like, he's the god. He's the god of sound mixing. And I was like, all right, that makes perfect sense, you know? And I'm going to look up the name of the composer because I forget her name, but she's fantastic as well. And I want to make sure we say her name. But in general, like, the sound and these Steadicam shots that follow Kayla are really, like, they're slight low angle shots of her for the most part and make the whole thing seem more grand. And I just think that it played really well on a big screen. And I have since read a lot of quotes of Bo Burnham talking about how he feels about how movies should be watched and all that stuff. And they tend to line up with a lot of my opinions. So I think that it makes sense that I was just always going to love this movie. It was just whenever I got around to seeing it. You know?
Is it just watch it in a movie theater and pay 100% attention to it?
No. So he says, first I want to point out the composer's name is Anna Meredith.
Okay. Just,
so we don't forget to do that. Yeah. Because this is her first film score.
I had Meredith in my head, but I forgot it was your last
name. Damn it, anyway. I had Anna in my head. We should have teamed up.
Two first names, like Jake Ryan. We'll talk about that, too.
Jake Ryan of Inside Llewyn Davis fame. But yeah, he talks about how like he wanted these things to play big and the music to play big. And one of the things I always say about movie theaters is I hate when the screen is lower than your eyes, because I feel like the screen should be like, you should be like looking at the screen like it's this vaunted thing, like it's this this piece of work that is above you, you know, and
like start of 2001 monolith monkeys looking at something they don't understand but are astounded by.
Exactly. And and I think that is a big part of why people, I mean, it's not a big part of, I think between the death of film projection and just losing a little of liveliness has hurt. And also most modern theaters, like if you go into any Cineplex that's been redesigned in the past 10 years or even 15 years, like the stadium seating, most people sit high near the top and you're kind of like looking down at the screen. And I don't know, you shouldn't be the god looking at the movie. The movie should be the god looking at you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because they put in a lot more work making the film than you did to get to it. I suppose with very small exceptions, if you fought your way out of the being abandoned in the Arctic to get to a screening of Eighth Grade. But he said something similar about how we use phones. And I think it's present in the Enya montage. He's talking about how your phone basically makes you feel like you're a god, because this is a quote. You'll scroll through your phone and in no particular order, you will see your mother, the president, Jiffy Lube, but all existing in the same tiny, awful space. And I think that's kind of like a really good way of putting how it fosters this mindset of everything should be like, everything I do should be important because I control everything else, you know, but Everybody is having that same experience. So
it's smaller than the film screen and you look down on it instead of looking up at it.
Yeah, exactly. And he contrasts this by saying to be smaller than a screen, and he's talking about filmmaking projection, but for you to be smaller than a screen, to be subjected before an image is very, very powerful. And I'm just like, yes, it is. It can be. And I feel like I could feel energy in the movie theater. And it was just really, really cool to experience. And the only other movie I felt that with last year was Sorry to Bother You, which is another similar experience. But I don't know. I just think it's cool to make such a low-budget movie. Every figure I've seen for this movie is that it was made for $2 million, not $2 billion. It's not Avengers. To still be able to be like, we're making this small movie with this comparatively very small amount of money, just because making movies is expensive, even though $2 million seems like a lot of money. And to really focus on making it feel huge is so cool. And to go back to that pool party shot, that zoom out of her standing at the glass door, that's a really good example of something, a very, like, could be a small moment seeming huge, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's interesting reading about it, Bo Burnham. I mean, he's a first-time director, and he just said that he just read books, like he read Sidney Lumet books on how to make movies. Like, yeah, just all.
I mean, that's a great book. I would recommend anybody read it. If you're reading one book on filmmaking, read that one.
Yeah, just because he was a YouTube star, and because of, you know, it seems like he wants to say something about now. Let's tell that story with some modern filmmaking techniques, and not that he doesn't. But just, it does seem like he, I mean, we talk about a checklist sometimes, and it always sounds so negative, but it just sounds like he had an idea of certain things that happen in good, big movies, and I want to make sure I hit a lot of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, the shot of her, it's really blue. She's lying on her bed, that, you know, it's the start of a scene, and she, you know, she's horizontal, but the image is in, made perpendicular, so it's like her face is looking straight on like a normal face would, but since she's lying down. Do you know what I mean? This scene.
I what is she doing in the scene? Is this when she's
It's
texting
yeah, she's
Gabe?
just lying in bed looking at her phone, but it
Oh, okay.
starts with just a straight up shot of her face.
No, I can't picture it, but
Okay,
there
well,
are a lot of shots like this in the movie, so
I agree. No, but it just feels very big and very epic and like a shot we've seen before, but I don't mean that in the pejorative sense, just something that I feel like he saw in enough movies and said, okay, this is this looks good and this has an impact. It's just kind of not startling, but just kind of it's just a good reset to kind of have you kind of reassess everything again. I think in a movie, as we said, there is a bit of just looking at your phone, how can we make this new and engaging? And that's one of them. And just on the subject of kind of little flourishes that I enjoyed, very, very near the beginning of the movie, she's doing her vlogs and stuff, and then they cut to her in school, and she's making these little clay animals in art class or whatever, these little clay pig, and I just the juxtaposition of her the other part of her creative life, if you want to put it that way, she puts on all this makeup to take a selfie about how she just woke up looking like this kind of thing, and posting it, and that's just one picture that's going to go away. And then there's this other one of her at school. She's got her, the guy's shirt on backwards with paint on it. The classic art outfit. And she's just not really caring what it looks like, and or what she looks like, but she's caring about what the product looks like. And just it's never really talked about. But it was just these two images placed very closely together, showing different forms of creative expression, and it doesn't really take a dig at one or the other. It's just these two contrasting ideas of different notions of creating something or art, or what it takes to make something that somebody else might see, and if that's a reflection of you.
Yeah, no, for sure. That's a good point. Yeah, and I think to go back to the like her modeling with clay, I think this movie does a really good job of very quickly and very entertainingly every once in a while just reminding us how young 13 really is. The opening credits where the kid's stacking markers, the girl is playing with the elastic on her braces. Those quick shots are very like, oh, these kids are young as shit. When they're in the truth or dare sequence, which I recognize is not comedic, but her dare is put this quarter in your mouth, which is a very like childish thing to say. And I th especially in that scene, I think it's a really good re time to remind the audience of just how young this kid is and how unprepared she is for what she's a part of right now. And I think now's as good a time as ever to talk about how fucking good Elsie Fisher is in this movie. Like, this movie is so totally dependent on her being likable, and I guess that's the whole sentence. And she's extremely likable.
Yeah, and it's again, it's not likable in a center of attention, owning the room, having a bunch of quips, kind of way. And I think sometimes I might overlook how good she is in this just because I haven't seen her in other things. Like she's just so embodied in this character for me, which is, a good thing.
Well, that's something that Bo Burnham has talked about. His partner is Lauren. I always pronounce her name wrong without looking it up, but Lauren Scarfia, I believe. I'm going to look that up just to make sure that I'm right. Who is a filmmaker? I think her last film was Seeking a Friend at the End of the World. That movie with Keira Knightley and Steve Carell. But like as he was writing it, she was telling him, "You're never gonna find a kid that can play this role." And I mean, like all stories where there's a kid being cast for a central role in a movie like this, he saw thousands of kids. Like it's the Jake Lloyd and the Phantom Menace thing. Like we got to see everybody. And but Elsie Fisher was the first person that he felt like was. She was a shy person trying to be confident, whereas he felt everybody else was a confident kid trying to be shy. And I think that's a key aspect of the movie. I think it's fantastic that, I mean, I assume she's wearing makeup in some capacity, but they're not covering up her acne. And that just goes into the whole kids looking like kids thing that I love so much about this movie, which is just a total disconnect from every other teen movie where like every guy takes their shirt off and they look as jacked as an NFL wide receiver, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. She's just so, the movie begins with you staring at her for 2 minutes, unbroken take. And you have to immediately be interested in this girl. You have to find her engaging, and you have to then want to continue to listen to her do the same thing for the next 93 minutes. That's so tough. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
the degree of difficulty is unbelievable. And I totally understand why somebody's partner would say, you're never going to find a kid who could play this.
Yeah, that's why I mean, when I think sometimes I underestimate it. It's just because of the naturalistic storytelling.
Yeah.
And I really do think I just kind of lose Elsie into Kayla.
Yes. I have watched enough interviews with her to realize that, like, that's probably not wrong, but most kids in movies are playing themselves in some capacity, but it's still, there's like a liveliness to Elsie Fisher, even if she's just playing herself, that is just so much more enjoyable than most child actors. And
and to do it in these situations and with all these people around, and to do it 40 times in a row for different, you know, different angles and things like that. It's,
yeah.
It's not as easy as just, hey, go be yourself. We're going to film it.
Yeah. Well, and another fun fact about Elsie Fisher is I believe Gucci ends up in the script because it was just something she would say on set to people.
Yeah.
And it became,
so it was more of a tick than like even a choice. It's just something that used to come out.
Exactly. And apparently it got to be such a catchphrase on the set that like gaffers would be saying to Bo Burnham, like, is this lighting setup? Is this Gucci? Like, just like it replaced good in the lexicon, basically. But I think something that points out how good Elsie Fisher is throughout this movie is there are a lot of scenes where she has to do a lot of different tones. And even if she's just playing herself, like that scene where she's calling her dad from the pool party and trying to get him to pick her up, and Aiden walks in. She is so funny in that scene, and she's like playing that scene like she doesn't play any other scene. The look of excitement when she's so excited that Olivia invites her to the mall that she like has to throw down her phone and like do a small lap of her room. That is so endearing. Every time she says thank you or love Kayla, just all of these things are done in different tones.
Okay.
And when she says, will you help me burn something in the backyard, is so funny. Also, the father, Josh Hamilton, the way he says yes in that sequence is hilarious. He's like, I think I have to, but I should be worried. But
that's a dad who's not like, okay, I'll just give you all the gas and matches. He's like, you're clearly going through something. I think he's very good at this.
Oh, he's fantastic. I do think we should, I mean, we will talk about him at some point, but, and just all of the different, different emotions Kayla goes through in this movie. And I feel like, the one other one is when she's, talking to Kennedy at the very end of the movie and just staring at the ground the whole time. Like that's a totally different style of performance that we've seen from this point, but it all feels real. It all feels like a part of the same person, and it's a part of the same person that's still figuring out who they're going to be. And, to be consistent while also being totally inconsistent, I think is so impressive. And,
yeah,
she's great.
Yes.
She's got an apology Oscar coming her way someday.
You think so?
I don't know. This movie didn't make a big enough imprint on culture.
Yeah. I mean, it seems that everybody who saw it liked it, but...
Yeah. Because it's fantastic.
Yeah. When you're talking about just all the... kind of all the different things that she has to do and all the different scenes in this movie kind of take you a different place. Just the notion that there is that school shooting scene, I guess it is a few scenes. Just add it to the list of things that, you know, take you on a roller this movie.
Oh, for sure. And I remember, again, seeing this for the first time. Like, the intro to that scene is just a shot of the gunman. You know, like, you don't,
Yeah.
like, immediately you're like, what the fuck is happening? Things
It's
have changed.
darker and
Oh,
yeah.
it just comes, and it comes out of nowhere, but it also is feels so rooted in reality, and the way that it's played is like reality played for comedy. Again, like, of course the kids from the drama department would be the people who are playing the victims. The girl who has just been shot in the head telling telling Kayla that Aiden's a dick. All of the way that and the way that the kids aren't taking it seriously, like the again the Le, that's the second time the LeBron James kid services. And the way Aiden's just like, yeah, I'd fuck him up if somebody came to the school. Like, all of that is so funny and so terrifying, and just my like I to say my jaw dropped is an over exaggeration, but my mouth definitely opened when that scene started because I don't know, it just feels like that's something that's totally new in a teen movie, like school shooting drill, you know, like that is I've seen a lot of teen movies, I've seen teen movies about school shootings, but like
Yeah.
doing a drill, I don't know that for whatever reason that's like darker than Elephant to me, the Gus Van Sant movie about Columbine, like I don't
Well,
know.
I think just because it's played so dry, it's just, yeah, this is something that they live with. This is just part of their reality. It's
Yeah.
not the horror of it actually happening. It's the constant threat that it might happen.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like it's the new fire drill to them, basically. Like I assume you did fire drills as a kid. I definitely did at school, and it's just oh my God. It's so dark. Yeah. One thing I can confirm in all of my Bo Burnham research is he's a pretty dark dude.
Okay.
He's very funny and very like empathetic, but like when you get to the bottom of it, I feel like he's a very dark human being. In a way that is positive for me personally. Have you seen a special Make Happy? Second special or third special maybe?
No, I'm going too soon, though.
I cannot recommend it highly enough.
Yeah,
Yeah.
based on the title alone.
So I don't know. So I mean we danced around it a bit, but I feel like we should mention the Truth or Dare sequence just because it's so good, but also I think its goodness is kind of self-evident. So it's kind of like the pool party in that I don't have a lot to say, but I also feel like it's so intense that it has to be mentioned. You know what I mean?
And so, I mean, the pool party sequence is impressive just from a kind of filmmaking standpoint. This is impressive from, I know this still kind of fits into filmmaking, but just from a honesty standpoint, and that it would be easier for everybody involved that this scene didn't have to be shot. But it's just sort of the unflinching, well, let's not, I mean, this is part of this reality as well, so
Yeah.
let's kind of deal with
Yeah, exactly. And I think the they don't do a lot of filmmaking stuff other than just sort of shooting the scene pretty standard, but I think the fact that the camera never leaves the back seat even when Riley gets out of the car to sort of like he crosses the car, hits the hood and comes and sits in the back seat. I think the fact that we stay the camera stays where Kayla is the whole time. I think that's a really good filmmaking choice and certainly heightens the terror. Not that like an external shot of the car would make the scene like any more interesting, it would make it less interesting. But you could totally see them doing an external setup for Riley getting out of the car and sitting in the back seat, right? And that they don't, they choose not to do that, I think is a really smart choice. And the other thing is that there's a little bit of light on Kayla, but Riley is almost entirely in darkness. And I think that's a nice, really subtle choice. That sort of paints him as a threat, you know, which is what he is in the sequence. And Bo Burnham's explanation of that scene is that he feels like sex ed in school just does kids a disservice because it's basically teaching you the X's and O's but not how to actually like navigate it. And I mean, in my experience in sex ed, that's true, but also I don't know, just everything about that scene just feels for something I've never experienced feels 100% dead on. And the fact that she is apologizing afterwards and he doubles down on being an absolute piece of shit is I don't know. Again.
I was reading about people at the film festival just kind of yelling at the screen, and
Oh yeah. It's
it just I saw it alone, which is another kind of awkwardness. I mean, sure, with a large group, it has a different kind of awkwardness, but yeah, no, I think it's 100% successful, and like Bo Burnham said in making a lot of parts of this movie, it's these aren't things that he has experienced directly, and it is something you and I aren't going to experience directly, just because we aren't 13-year-old girls and 20 whatever 18.
We also just aren't women.
Right. No, 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 no.
Not,
I think it's from people I've read, it rings true. It rings true to me in the sense that it is absolutely enthralling and in the most unpleasant ways. But yeah, it's one of those things that a good movie can do is make you feel that sense of, I mean, unease doesn't quite get there, but extreme discomfort and fear.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the one other smart filmmaking thing is, I mean, I haven't run the numbers, I haven't timed it out, but it feels like a very long scene in comparison to the lengths of the scene in the rest of the movie. It might just be because of the tone, but I think the fact that it doesn't end, like, I think it goes on longer than scenes like this in most movies would. Like that conversation when he does end up start driving her home and starts basically essentially like saying he was doing it for her,
Yeah, guilt
all
tripping
that.
her.
Yeah, exactly. That I feel like most movies you get the cut from him getting out of the back seat to her being like at home, and you don't get that middle part that is present in Eighth Grade. And I think that's where it's that extra like little element of adding an even extra layer of truth that I think makes it so unbearable. I mean, the
And
whole
that
thing's
could.
unbearable, but just
No, but I think you're right because I think that it takes it out of like it stops you from compartmentalizing it. It's like, oh, this thing happened to me, but that's in a little box in my past, and now we're done.
Yeah,
Like
exactly. Well,
it wouldn't stay with you. I mean, it wouldn't stay behind you like that.
and I think it's important that we know that Caleb feels like she is the problem in this sequence too, and that's what that conversation establishes and her
Yeah.
continuing
Oh,
to
yeah, for
apologize.
sure.
So the time capsule stuff I love. I feel like the last things I really want to talk about are the vlogs and I guess hand in hand with that is how buildings are presented cinematically, like through shots. That sequence where she asks her dad, like, can we burn something after she's watched her time capsule video of herself in sixth grade, sending a message to herself in grade eight, which is apparently something Bo Burnham actually did, which I find very, very charming. I think that's. It's fantastic. Anytime somebody in any piece of media is addressing their past or future self, I will always love it. I said Eighth Grade and Tully are my two favorite movies of 2018. It's no surprise both of those movies feature that thing happening.
Yeah, I've been thinking about the things that connect the two. But anyway,
Well,
continue.
and Bo Burnham's partner is one of Diablo Cody's best friends, but
Okay.
I didn't know they were partners at the. I knew her work, but I did not know that her and Bo Burnham had been together for like 5 years when I saw Eighth Grade, or until earlier today. But yeah, it's so fascinating. But anyway, I just found that the way that the movie. To get to the fire in the backyard, we have that very phone heavy first part, and then we transition to it being more of a tool to get in the room with Olivia or Gabe. I think it's really, really important that she's using something natural to destroy the time capsule. I mean, you would have to. It's like a hammer. If you really want to destroy something, you can't like text it to death,
Yeah.
But I think the fact that it's like an element is important, that they're lighting it on fire, that they're sitting around a campfire together, which is just such a traditional, like telling stories by the campfire sort of thing. It's just so human, and
Yeah, it's just
so
like primal. Like that goes back so far, right?
exactly. And there are elements of the movie that are about the relationship between physicality and technology. I mean, it's almost such an obvious metaphor that we don't need to mention it, but like when she breaks her phone and she's looking through the cracked glass, like the physical world can still damage the virtual and vice versa, because now that that screen is cracked, it cuts her when she's at the pool party. It cuts her thumb as she's trying to use it. But they're burning the time capsule. As we mentioned, Josh Hamilton, who plays the father, is very good, and that's his like big scene as a from a dramatic standpoint. And he's so good in that sequence. Kayla is so good in that sequence as he's explaining. I don't know how fascinating he finds her and all these things. And we've got that close up on Kayla, and it's just looking like down her face as she's like so sad. I mean, she just asked, "Do I make you sad?" Which is maybe the most depressing thing a 13-year-old can ask their parents. But like, there's just the tiniest hint of a smile. I forget what he says that sort of engages it, and just the beginning of her starting to feel better. And I never noticed it until the third time I watched this movie, or I guess fourth time I watched this movie. And that's such a small thing. It's such a small acting moment. It's hard to see because the sequence is so dark. The scene is so dark because it's lit by fire. And just that whole scene of them coming together, like, I don't know. It's so easy for a movie that has been so tonally kind of dark a lot of the time, and just in general, there's sort of a removed feeling throughout the movie. Like, Kayla constantly feels removed, and we're joking about things with no empathy whatsoever, like school shootings. But that it sort of nails the really big emotional sequence, I think, is it's really important. It's because it could have fallen off the rails if both of those actors don't do their job perfectly in that scene. Yeah,
and I think it's important. You know, we've said that technology isn't just kind of demonized here. We say it's inevitable and should be dealt with in the most positive manner possible. But I think you're right about them getting to that scene and it being so elemental with the fire. And we see Kayla use the excuse of bad reception a few times.
Yeah.
And you know, with anything, with any intermediary technology, you can blame part of it on that reception or the static or some kind of entropy once, you know, something else is involved in the communication. But that scene's about all of that being stripped away and so many other things being stripped away and them speaking very, very honestly. And you know, he's speaking to her like that at the dinner scene earlier about how cool she is making these videos and all that, but there isn't anything there. And you know, she can't blame something on bad reception, and they kind of are kind of forced to have this moment of very direct communication, and we find it's, you know, the sweetest thing you could hope for. That, you know, he's as nice as we kind of suspected that he was, and she's seeing that and, you know, being just a sweet bag.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the last thing that I really want to address is the vlog recordings. I mean, for the first few, when we see her recording them, we're seeing exclusively the digital presentation of her. Like, the first one, we're seeing her face, that slow zoom out as she's talking about being herself, or the importance of being yourself. And
well, and it's so bright and close up, and then we see her kind of alone in her room. You know, she does seem very in a dark place and isolated in the reality of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. But that we don't see that shot of like the real world until she is done recording, right? Like, I think that's important.
Yeah.
And the next couple of times she does a vlog, I don't think we see her outside of the recording itself at all. And her last two, the last two actual vlogs, not counting the message to herself, but the one where she's talking about growing up, and it's played over the montage of her at high school with Olivia. We can see like half of her face peeking out from beside her computer when we cut to her recording it. And, you know, we're getting further along in the movie. And then the last one, as she is sort of realizing she doesn't want to do vlogs anymore because she needs to figure herself out before she can tell other people what to do or what they should do. And we see only like the very bottom of the frame, you can see the purple of her laptop, but the rest of it is like her face from the chin up. And it's sort of like she's figuring out a way to escape this machine that she has been talking it to. I mean, she's just giving advice into the void for so much of this movie, and then she realizes she doesn't want to do it anymore, or it's not right for her, and she's almost like escaping it, like it's a prison. And I think that was a very cool filmmaking choice to run throughout the movie. And the last thing is I want to mention is that throughout the movie, we get a lot of Steadicam shots following her, walking towards the middle school, the intro, Kennedy's house, the pool party, the mall. And in these shots, as she's walking towards places that she's afraid of or feels anxious about, again, as I mentioned, these are kind of low angle shots. Like Kennedy's house especially just looks so imposing.
Despite
the fact that it's just like a big, nice house and she's going to a pool party. And it, again, it's a teen movie made like a horror movie. And the middle school in the intro is the same thing. Her walking to the pool party, there's no like giant structure, obviously, other than the pool. But still, that terror as she's walking past Kennedy and her friend flossing is very palpable.
If nothing else, this movie will make it into the film archive, and flossing and dabbing will be.
Yeah, it
remembered for history.
They nailed the timing on that. Like that, the teacher or principal or whatever dabs and the kids are flossing. Like they got it just at the right time for that to
work. Yeah.
And then the last one where we see her walking up to a big building is the mall, right? And then towards the end, after she's had chicken nuggets with Gabe and sort of established a friendship, or it seems like she's established a friendship, you know, we get her last. Her last recording, it's a message to herself, and it's over another montage. We see that time capsule gets buried in the ground again. Another sort of element of the earth, you know, like you're literally putting the time capsule in the earth. And as she's doing her last speech and we see the last shot of the movie, she's walking and the camera's following her again. And again, she's using her phone, but the idea is that she's kind of figured out how to use it without letting it use her. And there's just, it's kind of like there's an open road in front of her. There is no horrifying building on the horizon. It's like she's just walking to school and it's normal and nothing imposing is there. And there's nothing to say that, you know, everything's happy. I mean, she's going to high school. Not everything's going to be happy. You know, she's going to continue living the human existence. Like, there's going to be ups and downs. But I think the whole point of this movie is that she's now navigated these ups and downs and has learned something from them to take with her. And the main thing she has learned is that, like, or that these buildings just aren't as imposing anymore. Now she's sort of just living her life. And I think it's a great last shot. The line, "I can't wait to be you," as the end, could again have so easily seemed corny, but something about Elsie Fisher's delivery is just absolutely note perfect. And again, they finish with the joke when she says Gucci. And I think that's everything I love about this movie in one. There's film, or in one quick moment. You know, there's really impressive shots. The music that comes in at the end credits is really great.
Great performance.
Absolutely great performance, great writing. It's just a nice twist on a style of filmmaking I've already loved for my entire life, pretty much. And then just ending with a joke, you know, like not letting go of your tone, even when you're making your big emotional statement. And whatever Bo Burnham does next, I can't wait. Whatever Elsie Fisher does next, can't wait. I'm in. Sign me up. Put me on both of those fan club lists.
Yeah, I'll sign up for that.
All right, so thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man, and we will not be saying Gucci, so check back next time.